The Holy Gospel according to Luke, the 16th chapter. Jesus said, "There was a rich man who was dressed in purple and fine linen, and who feasted sumptuously every day. And at his gate lay a poor man named Lazarus, covered with sores, who longed to satisfy his hunger with what fell from the rich man's table. Even the dogs would come and lick his sores. The poor man died and was carried away by the angels to be with Abraham. The rich man also died and was buried. In Hades, where he was being tormented, he lifted up his eyes and saw Abraham far away with Lazarus by his side. He called out, 'Father Abraham, have mercy on me, and send Lazarus to dip the tip of his finger in water and cool my tongue, for I am in agony in these flames.' But Abraham said, 'Child, remember that during your lifetime you received your good things, and Lazarus in like manner evil things. But now he is comforted here, and you are in agony. Besides all this, between you and us a great chasm has been fixed, so that those who might want to pass from here to you cannot do so, and no one can cross from there to us.' He said, 'Then I beg you, Father, to send him to my father's house, for I have five brothers, that he may warn them, so that they will not also come into this place of torment.' Abraham replied, 'They have Moses and the prophets, they should listen to them.' He said, 'No, Father Abraham, but if someone from the dead goes to them, they will repent.' He said to him, 'If they do not listen to Moses and the prophets, neither will they be convinced, even if someone rises from the dead.'" The Gospel of the Lord. Living as we do in the most affluent nation in the world, we might well wonder if today's first reading from the prophet Amos and Jesus' parable of the rich man and Lazarus require us to retreat from our homeostatic sense of our own goodness. These are blistering readings that cannot even inventively be dismissed or even softened without being unfaithful to the words themselves. A possible escape from considering these texts is a portion of our second reading from 1 Timothy, where we find the words, "Of course, there is great gain in godliness combined with contentment. For we brought nothing into the world so that we can take nothing out of it. But if we have food and clothing, we will be content with these." Interesting words, considering our consumer culture that teaches that the person with the most things when they die is the winner. The rest of the second reading must have anticipated us, because it spares nothing in a scorching assault on the inordinate love of money, which plunges people and civilizations into absolute ruin. But it does celebrate the good news of Christ's redeeming work, which transforms the fever of getting things and more things into a holy and purposeful stewardship of God's generosity. A transformation or sanctification causes us to hear a merciful word from God that what is to rule our lives is not wealth, but the grace of God. Now, while studying our readings for today, an experience of many decades ago surfaced in my mind. I once coached my youngest son's basketball team. It all began early one evening with a telephone call from the president of the local basketball league. The league consisted of elementary school boys 10 and 11 years old, and often the fathers of these boys were recruited to coach the teams. Thus, the telephone call to me, they had gotten to the bottom of the list, no doubt. I was very busy in those days, especially during evenings when practice and games were scheduled at the local schools. Every night was already filled. But every dad needs to spend some time and energy with family if the time is there or not. So I agreed to coach my son and 8 other boys. It was after I had agreed to do this that I found out that the other coaches had already met together. And having known the athletic abilities of the pool of boys for years, chosen what they considered to be the best players for their teams. That left me with my son, an Islamic boy named Schwab, who might not be able to play during the month of Ramadan, 3 kids who were too short to get the ball to the rim unless they were standing perfectly still under the basket, threw underhanded with 2 hands. Maybe they could get the ball there if no one was covering them. And 3 boys who, like everyone else on the team, could not comprehend a moving zone defense. And that was the only way this team was ever going to see a rebound. Now, if you were counting, you might just have noticed that we had 8 players while the other teams had 9. That's when the grace showed up. Ricky signed up to play by the deadline, but after the other coaches had chosen their teams. And so Ricky was going to be on our team. Our team. And he was the best player in the league last year and would be again this year. The best player. But not even Ricky, with all of his gifts, could save us from the riches of the other teams and the haughty behavior of their coaches. One of the guiding rules of the league indicated that every player on a team had to play in at least 2 of the 4 quarters of the game. For our team, that meant that every player would play at least 2 full quarters. For every other team, that meant that their least talented players would play for only 2 or 3 minutes of 2 of the quarters of the game. And with the wealth of players that the other teams had, we would be losing games by 30 and 40 points. And still, as we struggled, the kids were being humiliated as the other teams ran up the score even further. And a great chasm was fixed between our team and the others. Where was the mercy? The biblical diatribe against the rich is not a condemnation of riches. Indeed, those who are rich have a rule of life set before them, a way to be both wealthy and spiritually well. As for those who in the present age are rich, says the author of 1 Timothy, command them not to be haughty or to set their hopes on the uncertainty of riches, but rather on God, who richly provides us with everything for our enjoyment. They are to do good, to be rich in good works, generous and ready to share, thus storing up for themselves the treasure of a good foundation for the future, so they may take hold of the life that really is life. With wealth comes great temptation, be that wealth simply of money and possessions, as wealth is so often defined in our culture, or other forms of wealth, such as knowledge, talent, time, or the privilege of the care of young souls on a basketball court. One of the most serious dangers is a creeping and growing indifference to human need, a sense of entitlement, claiming wealth is merely one's own, coupled with the conviction that those who are less well off or needy have only themselves to blame. Listen to how the prophet Amos describes the danger. And notice that it isn't luxury itself he condemns. Woe to those who lie on beds of ivory and lounge on their couches and eat lambs from the flock and calves from the stall, who sing idle songs to the sound of the harp and, like David, improvise on instruments of music, who drink wine from bowls and anoint themselves with the finest oils, but are not grieved over the ruin of Joseph. The words of the prophet may very well be addressed to the wealthy classes in Jerusalem and Samaria as the Assyrians begin to conquer the northern kingdom in the 8th century before the Christian era. The main concern of Amos is not necessarily the obscene amount of money possessed by people or the use of the leisure time of the beautiful people of his day, but the way it makes serious thought and life definitely out of place. No one wants to talk about the state of the poor and oppressed at a banquet of excess or when they're on a permanent vacation. Wealth can be quite a distraction, even when the devil's army is at your gate. And a poor man like Lazarus in Jesus' parable today can easily be overlooked. Luke's parable of Lazarus and the rich man continues Jesus' instructions to his disciples about money. Luke is the only gospel writer to include this parable, which is consistent with Luke's concern for the poor. It is another reminder of how easily power and privilege can blunt our perspective. The wealthy man is unable to see the injustice perpetrated on Lazarus. Indeed, the poor man was probably not even noticed by the rich man. It is interesting to note that Lazarus is the only character in Jesus' parables who is named among the memorable characters like the prodigal son. What was his name? The Good Samaritan, his name. The persistent widow, what was her name? We don't know. They're anonymous. Perhaps this was pointing to God's special concern for the poor. The critique of the rich man, his wearing the expensive color purple, costs a lot in those days, dressed in fine linen, feasting sumptuously while Lazarus lay covered in sores at his gate, longing to satisfy his hunger along with the dogs with what fell from the rich man's table. Ignored by the rich man, the lonely dogs may have tended to poor man Lazarus by licking his sores with curative saliva. Even after his death, the rich man was unable to perceive the inequalities that caused Lazarus' suffering. As far as the rich man was concerned, Lazarus existed only to serve his needs, as exhibited by his request to Father Abraham to send Lazarus to dip the tip of his finger in water and cool the rich man's tongue, and then again to send him to his father's house to warn his brothers of the dangers of complacent exaggeration of wealth. It may seem generous of the rich man to care about his brothers at all, but he yet remains blinded by pride, not the healthy kind of pride that gives thanks for blessings, but the haughty arrogance that believed not only was he better than others, he couldn't see the chasm that existed between his life and the life that really is life. Though all of our readings today seemingly revolve around the use of wealth, they point to something far deeper than simply sharing food and other possessions. The even deeper meaning here has to do with a more pervasive attitude of neighborliness towards others. It seems to be absent. True charity is more than flipping a coin to a beggar. It is not spasmodic or superficial. Fundamentally, neighborliness is the barometer of the soul, an indication of the attitude of one's heart that is prized by God. It is exemplified by justice and sacrifice and generosity and honesty and humility and mercy. All such traits that were missing from the very formation of a kids' basketball league in which I was honored to coach 9 wonderful young men who hungered after just one win. It came at the end of the season when we played the champions from the year before. It was simply amazing. Those talented players seemed to have bricks in their hands, dribbled the ball off of their feet, out of bounds, tripped over one another, couldn't make a shot. Our Lazarus team couldn't miss one. They all seemed to go in. Even the kids who had to throw underhanded, they made some baskets. I watched my watch for the end of the game, and their parents were hopeful. When the final buzzer sounded, what a celebration theirs was with the kids and their parents. Too bad the chasm that separated the two teams was too great for the other team to join in the moment of grace. Too bad they had not yet learned and were not being taught what life is really all about.